Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this, you know the day, Monday, April 15th, Tax Day, and it's all things political. We have a lot to talk about this hour. We'll be looking at gun legislation. We may talk about taxes because today is income tax day. We'll look at Social Security and the president's budget and the Republicans' budget. And our guest this hour's most recent piece is on what American conservatives can learn from Margaret Thatcher. Our guest this hour has joined us frequently on All Things Political. He is Jeffrey Lord, contributing editor of the American Spectator. He's a former Ronald Reagan White House political director and former aide to Jack Kemp. We'll be welcoming your phone calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, should you care to use that, we hope you will, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Jeffrey Lord, hello. Happy Tax Day.
Happy tax day to you, Kathleen, if such a thing could be said.
I know I have to mail all of those today. I hope it's not jammed at the post office. I think
exactly.
It might be.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, when I used to live in Washington, I would go by the post office in downtown Washington, D.C., and the line would stretch for around the block.
Oh, I better plan a big chunk of the afternoon then for such a task.
That's right.
Huh? Okay. Let's start with the piece that you wrote most recently. What is it that American conservatives can learn from Margaret Thatcher, Jeffrey?
Stick to principle, which was also Ronald Reagan's main issue. I think that, you know, there's this sort of eternal rift. I think that's been going on now for about 100 years since Teddy Roosevelt challenged William Howard Taft back in 1912 between so-called Republican moderates and conservatives. And I think over time, conservatives have gotten the better of the deal. But the issue always becomes one of, and it doesn't matter really what the issue is, are they sort of drifting, are they, meaning Republican moderates, drifting more to the other side than sticking to principle? And Margaret Thatcher came to power in Britain in the first place because after decades of socialism in Britain and the British Conservative Party leaning leftward, she finally challenged Edward Heath for the party leader's job after he had just lost an election. And the rest, as they say, is history. And she was there for... She was elected three times and really steered Britain in quite a different direction. And, of course, there's still controversy. But just as a political leader, I think there's a lot to learn from her.
Mm-hmm. There was a piece in the Times yesterday by a professor of history at Princeton who said, and I'm wondering what you think about this, like Churchill before her, Mrs. Thatcher was always more uncritically admired in the United States than in Britain. Here she was a world leader of unrivaled charisma and authority. There she was a partisan politician who regarded her enemies as knaves or fools or Marxists.
She did not have, you know, there is one difference between she and Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was totally, always an utterly charming soul, good sense of humor, a very pleasant demeanor. You know, people liked him. Margaret Thatcher had about her this sort of demeanor of, as I think her enemies called her at the time, of as a schoolmarm. And, you know, she would point the finger and wag the finger, et cetera. They were saying, in essence, the same thing. But, of course, how you say it depends a great deal on how your message is received. And Ronald Reagan always said things with a smile. Mrs. Thatcher sometimes seemed, quite stern. And I think that probably accounts for her lack of popularity with some people in Britain. But then again, you know, I'm always amused by people who say that ex-politician fill-in-the-blank is not popular, and yet that person keeps getting elected. That is the ultimate test of whether or not they're popular, is whether they can win an election. And she certainly did three times out.
Mm-hmm. And you would certainly know the answer to this. Were they indeed, Reagan and Thatcher, very, very good friends? Or is that something the press has made too much of?
No, they were. They were good friends. President Reagan met her for the very first time on April 9th of 1975, after she had become the... leader of the Conservative Party, and he at that point was just the former governor of California, thinking about challenging Gerald Ford the following year. And she made a point of seeing him when he was visiting Britain. They hit it off immediately and met a number of times thereafter before he was elected president. and after, before and after she was elected prime minister, and then when he was elected president, they, you know, dealt with each other quite frequently. And I remember one occasion, and I think it was the Falkland Islands, where he had, or Grenada, it might have been Grenada, I think, where, you know, Grenada, the United States had invaded Grenada to stop a communist overthrow. But Grenada, of course, is under the purview of the Queen and the British government, and she was quite upset with him, and she called him and you know, was yelling at him over the phone, and he put his hand over the receiver and you know, held it out so the cabinet members who were with him could hear, and he said, "Isn't she marvelous?"
Oh my. And he wasn't very happy from what I've read about the Falklands, was he?
No, I think he did have it wrong. Not that he had any brief for the Argentine dictator, but, you know, the Monroe Doctrine and all of that sort of thing, I think he was concerned about. And he sent Al Haig over there, who was then the Secretary of State, to see Mrs. Thatcher numerous times. And, of course, she wouldn't bend at all. And, you know, this tension was picked up a little bit in this movie with Meryl Streep, in which Al Haig is visiting her and she offers to make tea and all this while he's busily lecturing her about what it is to be a fighter in life and all this, and she, you know, she looks him right in the eye and she says, "Al, I've been a fighter all my life," something to that effect. So no, he wasn't very happy, but they got over, they had a great personal relationship and they got over these things. The last time I saw President Reagan was at his birthday party in 1994, and she came and gave a wonderful speech for him. And, you know, the two of them were together that one last time, and it was wonderful to see them.
If we do follow her example and stand on principle, don't we run the risk of what we're seeing now in Washington, and that's little gets done? We describe this era as one of excessive bipartisanship, or partisanship, rather.
You can see that. And, you know, there is much being made these days of, as a matter of fact, he's on the cover of the American Spectator, the physical magazine, the American Spectator, this month, is Calvin Coolidge. And the argument is being made that Calvin Coolidge knew when not to do things, and that we too often are in a rush to do things, and we wind up regretting them later. And I think when you're dealing with issues like gun control, immigration, et cetera, these are issues that require a lot of thought. People have very strong feelings on these things, and the idea of rushing things through is never a good thing, that a lot of thought needs to be put into them. And sometimes the best thing is to do nothing. I'm not saying necessarily in those cases, but the urge to act, to do something, quote unquote, when, you know, can frequently backfire.
Let's get on to what the Senate will be debating for the first time in 20 years, and that is gun safety legislation. Please tell me, and a lot of people are asking this question, Jeffrey, with 90%, polls are showing that it's about 90% of the American public being in favor of background checks that are much tighter. How can the Senate even consider something else?
Well, first of all, I think the polls are deceptive, as a lot of polls usually are. When you go into states, and first of all, let me start by saying states with Democratic senators, states like Montana or Louisiana, for example, those polls may say 90% in a national sense, but when you get to individual states where senators have to run for re-election, that's just not the case. And I've noticed here as over the weekend that people like Senator Baucus from Montana, who's the head of the Senate Finance Committee, has indicated he may not support this legislation. You get to people like Senator Landrieu from Louisiana, and senators from Arkansas, Mark Pryor, and there are others, Senator Begich from Alaska, who's a Democrat, and they're hearing from their constituents, and their constituents, you know, are very concerned about the Second Amendment, and so therein lies the rub. So the polls, I think, can be deceiving, because it all depends, as it always does with these things, how the question is asked and all of that kind of thing. But when it comes right down to the rub, the real nitty-gritty of dealing with their constituents and their states, there is a problem there, and that's why I'm a little skeptical of how far this is going to get. I can give you, Kathleen, a little bit of a news tweak here. Senator Toomey from my state of Pennsylvania has been leading this charge with Senator Manchin on background checks.
Mm-hmm.
And this weekend, Pennsylvania, first of all, is a heavily pro-gun state, anti-gun control state. It's been a huge issue here in the past, and politicians generally try not to, you know, get involved with it on the gun control side of the issue. This weekend is here in suburban Harrisburg is what they call the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, which is the state version of CPAC, with conservatives gathering here. And Senator Toomey has always been a prime member of this group. And this weekend he's facing, as I understand it, and talking to people, some real opposition within the conservative wing of Pennsylvania Republican Party over this issue, because he has gone out there on the background check issue. So he will be here along with the president of the Heritage Foundation, former Senator Jim DeMint, Deneen Borelli, and I think Brent Bozell. I mean, this is a conservative type of thing. And so he certainly will be here, and it will be very interesting to see the reaction that the greeting that he receives.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, of course, that has happened is Newtown, and we have seen the parents of those who have lost children in that horrendous, horrendous massacre all over Washington, changing some minds among some senators. It's one of those events in our national consciousness that it seems to me may change things.
You know, it's horrific, and I don't begrudge the parents of Newtown anything. You know, what happened, and they're going to have their say and should be heard, and they are being heard. Interestingly, there is one member of their group who disagrees, and he's apparently being given short shrift by the president. I've seen this guy on the last I saw him. His name escapes me at the moment, but he was on with Megyn Kelly, and he broke down in tears on live television in discussing this. So, you know, it's just your heart goes out to him, but he is very much opposed to more gun control. And at least as I'm understanding this gun measure, this would have had no effect on what happened in Newtown, where the gun was registered, was legal, and this kid, you know, got into it, and you know, the kid had problems himself. I personally, at least as I'm understanding this, I think that what's very interesting here is the reaction of the mental health community to this. As I understand it, there have been some real opposition to, not to the gun control part of it, but to further checks on people with mental illness, and that they are very sensitive about this. And of course, this was this kid's problem, and why he was not committed, as it were, or you know, under some sort of supervision is something I think really bears looking into.
And yet, the NRA was in favor of universal background checks not that long ago. Do you know why they changed their position?
All I can go from is what I've heard Wayne LaPierre say, and I've known Wayne for about 20 years or so, and I heard him say in one interview that this imposes an imposition on somebody who's in some small town part of America, which is to say a lot of America, who wants to go out and buy a gun, who's perfectly qualified to buy a gun, and suddenly has to go through all of this bureaucracy to, you know, exercise his Second Amendment rights. And so that, I think, is the concern about universal gun control. And I don't know how many people saw this story in the last few days of a guy in western New York, in Erie County, New York. New York State has passed this very stringent gun control law, and this gentleman was notified by authorities that, I guess, he had 7 guns. He was a target shooter. And somehow, in violation of the law, they had accessed his health records, and they notified him that he had to turn in his guns. Well, the bottom line is, he was the wrong guy. And he had to turn his guns in, and I guess they're being restored to him and all of this. But this goes to exactly the concern, I think, that the NRA and a lot of people have about, an overweening government just rushing in and doing something, and then they make a mistake, and somebody has to surrender their weapons, and in this case it was done, and it was done in error, and there was an apology from the state police and all this kind of thing. So it is a very thorny issue,
mm-hmm.
indeed.
When you look at states that have experienced massacres, Colorado, Connecticut, New York, a lot of gun violence, do you see a movement, a couple movements here, one on the part of states, and particularly those that have experienced this kind of horror, to move toward gun safety legislation? Do you see that as something that will happen with other states in the country?
I think it has been happening, and as a matter of fact, I saw something just the other day, listening, I think there were about 20 states that have moved in some of these different directions. And the question was, is this in violation of the Heller decision, which is a Supreme Court decision, which allows, in which basically says you have a Second Amendment right to own a gun. And is this encroachment? So, I mean, I do think it's happening. And as I believe I heard this morning, there have been some 80 challenges along the way in different states, and they've all been rejected by the federal courts in favor of the Second Amendment. So, but I would certainly expect, I would agree, I think that there are going to be more of these proposals coming up as we go along on a state-by-state basis. You know, we too often get, just in general, not having anything to do with guns, but we too often get fixated on the federal government and what the federal government can do. And you forget, of course, there are 50 different states out there, and there are all of these folks within those states who are pro and anti a particular issue, in this case guns, and so they will try and move through state legislatures and with governors and, you know, cities and all of that kind of thing to enact different laws.
And your thoughts about what the Senate does this week, Jeffrey?
I think it's unclear, frankly. I think that there are real problems within each party caucus. I think that Republicans are divided, and I think Democrats are divided. If I had to bet, I would say they didn't get anything done, but I could be wrong on this. I mean, they are sufficiently divided internally, each party, that it makes it unclear here as to how this is going to work.
We're going to welcome phone calls and move to other issues. Jeffrey Lord is our guest this hour. He's contributing editor of the American Spectator, former Ronald Reagan White House political director, and former aide to Jack Kemp. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. The president is taking some heat from some Democrats who are saying that you can't be a good Democrat and cut Social Security. Will there be a strong challenge in terms of running candidates in primaries before the midterm elections who will run on this particular issue, because it's an important one to many Democrats? We'll ask Jeffrey that. And welcome your phone calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Franz DeWall has a new book. He is now biology professor at Emory University and director of the Living Link Center at the Primate Center in Atlanta. He's regarded as one of the world's top experts on primatology, especially the sometimes violent chimpanzees and the more peaceful cousins, the bonobos. And he has written a book that looks at this very large question: are we moral because we believe in God, or do we believe in God because we are moral? He has reached some basic conclusions that chimps and bonobos and other primates clearly show empathy with others who are suffering. They have a sense of fairness. They take care of those who are in need. They'll share what they have with others who are less fortunate. He has written about all of this in a fascinating new book, The Bonobo and the Atheist in Search of Humanism Among the Primates. That's hour number two of our conversation. Jeffrey Lord is with us this hour. We'll move on to Social Security in a moment. But first, let's take some phone calls. Mary in Eau Claire is our first caller. Jeffrey, hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm wondering why no one has suggested drug testing prior to gun purchases. I mean, background checks and all are very good, but, you know, to get any kind of a job these days, just about, you have to have pass a urinalysis drug test. And it seems to me it's only, well, we don't want drug abusing gun owners.
Jeffrey.
Well, again, you get into a question of Second Amendment rights, and whether it's background checks or the kind of checks you're suggesting. And I would say, just off the top of my head here, particularly the kind of thing you're suggesting, the Constitution, in the view of many people, gives an immutable right to own a gun. It doesn't say anything about drug tests. It doesn't say anything about background checks. It doesn't say anything about a lot of these things. So I'm sure there would be quite a bit of opposition to it. Now, that's not to say somebody wouldn't take your idea and run with it, but I'm not sure that it would have a lot of support for that reason as an intrusion on your personal rights.
Thanks very much for your call, Mary. Let's go to Randy in Pewaskum. Hi, Randy.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Randy.
Okay, thing is, when a lot of resistance to the background checks now as opposed to earlier, you look at the administration we have now, they have been working to be, they're extremely anti-Second Amendment. You've got an administration that a while ago tried to claim that 96% of the guns used in crime in Mexico came from the United States. That was proven false. You've got Eric Holder is basically he's a criminal. Fast and furious, he's hiding his emails. There's another anti Second Amendment type sting that they were trying to go and gin stuff up. And I noticed you were all of a sudden calling it gun safety measures. You used to call it gun control measures. It's basically people that don't like the Second Amendment or, well, whatever we got to do to get it through, we got to do.
Eric Holder is a criminal, Jeffrey?
Well, Eric Holder is pretty controversial, I will say that. And I think there is an issue with Fast and Furious and, how the United States government happened to have guns that got into the hands of Mexican drug dealers. I do think that there's an issue about that. I'm not in the business of judging whether somebody's a criminal here unless there are charges made and hearings and proceedings and all of that. So I'll sort of take a pass on that one. But I think certainly he's very controversial. I think he's, in my opinion at least, he certainly made a big mistake on Fast and Furious. And I do think that that's going to come to, is coming back to haunt them in the case of the gun control issue. Because if you'll remember, one of the schools of thought out there was that they were doing this in the Justice Department to gin up support for gun control measures by saying, see, they got a hold of these guns from America and they've committed all these crimes, and so therefore we need to have gun control. And of course the scheme, if that was the scheme, went awry and people were killed, Americans were killed, and so there is a problem. There is a pretty considerable problem there. Randy is right about that, but how that plays out in terms of any criminality charges and all that, I'm a little skeptical that would come to pass.
Now, nonetheless, you've got a president here who had to respond to what happened in Newtown. This was something that has not happened before. Six-year-old kids were murdered. You've got a situation in Colorado where people were in a movie theater. You have things happening on campuses all over the country. To say that this is an attempt by the president to get rid of people's guns, the president is responding to an enormous tragedy that most Americans felt pretty deeply. This is the issue. They don't want it to happen again.
Yeah, I think that's true. And the one thing that I would caution, and I hate to confess my age here, but I first recall this debate after President Kennedy was assassinated, which in itself was a terribly traumatic incident for the country. And gun control, as I recall at the time, pretty much failed then. We always have to be careful here when we get to the point of legislating things, of letting emotion drive things. I mean, this was a horrific event. But I often hear, Vice President Biden say, well, not another life should be lost and all of this kind of thing. Well, of course, lives are lost all the time with automobiles and texting, and I mean, there are ways that there are deaths in this country that far outnumber those inflicted by guns, and yet nobody is saying, well, we should put a halt to this. I myself wrote a column right in the aftermath of Newtown, because one of the things that pro-life folks say is that there is a quote-unquote culture of death out there, which so diminishes the importance of life that it leads to the kind of thing that happened at Newtown. Well, I've never heard anybody say, well, gee, we should repeal Roe versus Wade because it in part played a role in Newtown, and I think you would have a huge uproar if in fact there were people advocating that. So I do think we have to be careful here with emotion. I mean, there is no answer here to these parents and their grief. None. I mean, you can't second guess them. I mean, this is their child. I certainly understand this, but there is more going on than just that, and this is why I think we have to have very calm appraisals of the situation here and understand, again, that what's being proposed, at least as I understand it, would not have stopped what went on in Newtown.
Let's move on to Social Security. Our callers can go wherever they want, but let's move on to Social Security for a moment. The president has more than a few Democrats upset with him with proposals to trim future benefits of Social Security to deal with deficit reduction. There are some who are saying that this is an issue that is near and dear to Democrats, and there will be if you're in favor of this, there are going to be some primary challenges to you in the midterm elections.
You know, one of the interesting things, I'm on a mailing list for reasons that I don't understand for Governor Howard Dean's, former Governor Howard Dean's group, Democracy for America. And the moment word leaked that the president was going to be proposing this, Governor Dean's group was at Democracy for America, I believe it's called, was out there extremely upset with the president, saying things like, you know, well, our friends and neighbors were out there for President Obama, and now he wants to cut Social Security. So, you know, and that was, I would say, within a half hour of in this day and age, you know, pretty rapid response here from one very big liberal group. So I think that, you know, there is a problem here for President Obama on this. Social Security is, you know, as they like to say, the third rail of American politics. If you touch it, you die, politically speaking. And I do think that there's going to be a problem here. The basic problem is that the Social Security folks themselves say that, you know, we're at a certain point, the till will be empty down the road, and we have to do something to fix it, otherwise it won't be there. So how you do that, of course, my own mom is on Social Security, of course. And how you do this and the way you do it and whether, you know, you can increase the age limit, et cetera, these are all questions. And the president has touched on it and has gotten a response from his own left on this. And I do think that there could be primary challenges out there for members of the Democratic Party who sign on to this. And I think they're probably very aware of it.
Does it help in trying to reach the Republicans? He says more than halfway.
Well, I'm not so sure that it does. I mean, that's the feedback that I've heard. They feel that he's not doing enough. You know, and of course, this is just part of the ebb and flow of negotiation on issues like this. But certainly, I've heard the complaint that he hasn't done anywhere close to enough. And you know, this is a very to move from guns to Social Security. This is a very divisive issue and has
right.
been for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Here. And I sometimes wonder if in fact what's going to happen is we're just going to keep doing nothing until the system crashes, and then you really do have a problem on your hands.
Let's go to Jim next in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. What I talked to the screener about was that, of course, April 1st is April Fool's Day, but April 15th is also a Fool's Day because, of course, it's Taxpayer Day, and that's the day that we pay for all of the con manipulations that go on to overhype the defense budget, such as, for example, Ronald Reagan saying that the Contras were only 4 days or 4 hours drive away from Texas, which again was to yoke us up to help the Contras. So we pay the price of that on an ongoing basis, and one of the prices we pay, of course, is the Social Security issue. Also, just a quick hitchhike on the other issue that you've been talking about is that the Republicans don't want to limit the constitutional rights of people to register for guns, they only want to limit the constitutional rights of poor people and black people to register to vote.
Jeffrey.
Wow. Well, first of all, in terms of President Reagan's dealings with the Nicaraguan Contras was part of his larger strategy to end the Cold War, and it worked. We are not spending money on the Cold War anymore. It's over. It went on for 50, 60 years, and President Reagan, along with Margaret Thatcher, and I would also say Pope John Paul II, combined to be an enormous force. The Berlin Wall is gone. I think the last of it was taken down in the last few weeks. It's over. There is no more Soviet Union. The people of Eastern Europe are free. We don't have troops in Nicaragua, etc. So I think his strategy worked. And on tax day, I think it's worth noting it's a lot of money that has not been spent since on that issue. In terms of voting, I'm a little puzzled. We have an ID law here in Pennsylvania. The idea is a very simple one, that you should be who you are. I mean, we've had, for fact, real incidents of voter fraud here in Pennsylvania with people claiming addresses that, are vacant lots, saying that they live there and there is no one there, and they show up. Not long ago, speaking of Eric Holder, somebody showed up to prove the point and showed up in Eric Holder's voting precinct in Maryland. I believe he lives in Chevy Chase, Maryland. They walked in there and said, hi, I'm Eric Holder. I'm here to vote. And the person on the other end there said, okay, that's fine. Let me give you your situation. And the guy said, well, do I need an ID? They said, no, Mr. Holder, you're listed here. Here's a ballot. And they said, well, let me go get my ID, because, of course, they weren't going to actually vote in his place. But they walked out. They recorded the whole thing, I think. And the point being made, here was the attorney general, somebody using the name of the attorney general of the United States himself in his own voting precinct. And the officials in Maryland were ready to give this complete and total stranger a ballot and let him vote as Eric Holder. So, I mean, this has nothing to do with race. I mean, the Democratic Party has a terrible history on race, rejecting civil rights bills after the Civil War, one right after another, including, I might add, the push to end slavery in the 13th Amendment. So I don't really think that their record on race is as great as they'd like to pretend it is.
Do you really, Jeffrey, though, believe that voter fraud is a huge problem in this country?
I do believe it's a problem. I do believe it's a problem. I mean, I have seen instances, again, right here in Pennsylvania where this is a problem. And I don't think there is anything wrong. I mean, we are asked for IDs everywhere along the line in life. If I go to cash a check at the bank, I have to produce an ID. Now, that said, I think that the government should hand these out to people. I mean, I think that, if you've got a problem for income reasons or whatever, or you can't get there to do it, I think a registrar should show up on your door, take your picture, give you the ID so you have it. But we managed to give Social Security checks to people. We managed to require voter ID to get on airplanes, to go to the bank, to go to a liquor store, to do all these things. It seems to me that voting is much more important than that. And if we, ask, I don't see anything wrong with that. It's a constitutional right to vote, and you should be able to prove who you are.
Let's talk just briefly about North Korea before we go back to phone calls. The news yesterday was that this was the day that North Korea would have chosen for the test launch of its most powerful missile, because it's the birthday of Kim Jong-un's grandfather. It's late in North Korea, so it's probably not happening today. But this threat's been going on for a few weeks now. Secretary Kerry said yesterday that there would be direct talks with North Korea, and we need to find a way to find peace. What do you know about direct talks with North Korea? Is it in the offing here soon? And are you worried that this launch of their most powerful missile is imminent, or just another thing to keep things riled
Kathleen,
up?
I have to say, not only do I not know, but I don't think Secretary Kerry or anybody knows. North Korea is a closed society, and I think we don't have any answers to the question. We see all these photographs of Kim Jong-un there, who, after all, is 28 years old. Not that I have anything against being 28 years old, but I have absolutely no idea whether he really is the boss of North Korea. I've read reports that his father's sister, I think it is the sort of Iron Lady behind all of this, or that various generals in North Korea, I don't think anybody knows. I think that the answer to this in some fashion lies through China, because I can't believe the Chinese are very, very, very thrilled with all of this. This is not something that they necessarily want going on either. So good luck to Secretary Kerry. I think this is a very unstable situation. It's a very close society. I'm not at all sure about the mental capacities of this guy. And you know, they do have nuclear weapons. I am hard pressed to believe that they would do this. But then again, rationality is not always you know, a factor that counts in some of the things that go on in international affairs. Mm-hmm. Adolf Hitler, to take one example, was not terribly rational, and yet he managed to become Chancellor of Germany, and we know all the rest. So, you know, you're very concerned about a miscalculation here, that they would do some small thing that would launch the South Koreans to respond, and then you get into this back and forth, and it would be quickly spinning out of control. So I think it's a very difficult situation.
I've heard that we don't even know exactly how old he is. It's maybe 28, maybe 29, maybe 30.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we just don't know. And they have so locked themselves away that periodically, you know, somebody gets in there, Franklin Graham or somebody like this, to deliver food and all this kind of, or Dennis Rodman, God bless him.
Right.
You know, it's a little spooky to me that we're depending on Dennis Rodman for information about North Korea. But, you know, you take what you can get here. But it is a very disturbing thing, and we just plain don't know. And that complicates things immensely for President Obama and Secretary Kerry.
Jeffrey Lord, our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political. We do this every Monday at 9 o'clock to look ahead at what's going to be debated, what the issues are this week, and what we've been through the past weekend and the week before. Jeffrey is contributing editor of the American Spectator. He's the former White House political director for Ronald Reagan and former aide to Jack Kemp. Here's our phone number. We've talked about gun legislation and Social Security and voter ID in North Korea, and feel free to comment on those or move us into new areas. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We have a couple lines open. And you could send a message, too. We haven't had any messages today. That's talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, Hour 2, primatologist Franz DeWall, and his new book is The Bonobo and the Atheist in Search of Humanism Among the Primates. I meant to mention this last week, and I didn't, but tomorrow, today really is Jackie Robinson Day in 1947. It's the day that he stepped onto the field with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and the rest is important history. So we're going to be talking about Jackie Robinson tomorrow. I hope some of you have had a chance to see the film, because our conversation was prompted by the release of 42, which opened on Friday in theaters all over the country. I had a chance to see it and really enjoyed the film yesterday. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about Jackie Robinson with Scott Simon from NPR, who wrote a book a couple of years ago, Jackie Robinson and the Integration of Baseball. We'll also be speaking with a wonderful man, Mr. Beckham, who threw out the first pitch at the Brewers game for opening day, and he was a member of the Negro Leagues. He has started, started a campaign to get Central City Milwaukee youngsters interested in baseball, and he has really a field of dreams in downtown Milwaukee. He hopes one day the Little League Championship of the country will be played there, and he has brought a lot of young people into baseball. The fields are beautiful, and he is a wonderful man. So he will be with us as well as we celebrate Jackie Robinson tomorrow, and that's during our 10 o'clock hour. All right, two more phone calls for Jeffrey Lord from the American Spectator. We go to John next in Rib Lake. Hi, John.
Good morning. I have a question with regard to the Social Security. What I always understood, based upon what I learned in school, And also, you know, just the way it was always, you know, payroll deduction, that Social Security is a, you know, administration. It's all out there by itself, funded by, you know, payroll taxes, by interest earned on the on all the money that's taken in, and then also on tax dollars that Social Security recipients pay. Regardless of all that, you know, Social Security doesn't borrow from any place, but the government always borrows from it. That's why the thing is, you know, pretty much, you know, touted as being bankrupt. Government doesn't want to pay back. It's uses the fund for, you know, a variety of things, including George Bush's wars, most recently. But if those things, if the government would sort of pay back, Social Security wouldn't be broken, and there's no justification for taking away from what I, the benefits that I'm going to get from what I paid into. It's not an entitlement program; it's a benefit program.
Jeffrey.
Well, I would partially agree with you here. There is no quote-unquote lockbox. I think that was an Al Gore phrase that he liked to use. And the government, for decades and decades and decades, has, number one, been borrowing from Social Security. But number two, it has also created, you know, added on to the program in ways that were not intended. In other words, this is no longer just a benefit program where, you know, you put in your money, and then at the end of your working life, you know, when you hit 62, 5, 7, whatever the age turns out to be, that you then collect the benefits. What's happened is that they have added all measure of other benefits to it that haven't been properly funded. Now, you add on to that the problem with people like me, which is to say I'm a baby boomer, and there are so many of us that we are going to, I think, add considerably to breaking the piggy bank here. They simply didn't account for the number of people that would be surging into the system. And on top of that, you had the fact that, as we all know, I'm sure everybody listening to me exercises and eats right, because something must be going on here, because we're living longer. I think the average age in the day when Social Security was passed, they didn't expect to see you make it much past 65. And I can tell you, taking care of my 93-year-old mom every day, you know, we are getting older as a country and living longer. And so, therefore, that impacts the Social Security system. So the combination of these problems have and will create a real problem here for the system itself.
I think it's really nice you're taking care of your mom.
Well, I love her to death. My parents were great with me, and so she's still hanging in there. You know, we have all the usual old age problems,
mm-hmm.
but I must say I've learned, I've done this both with my dad and my mom, and he's now gone, and, you know, you learn a lot about how all of this goes and the woes that you face, that we will all face if we make it to that age.
Yes.
And it's been very instructive for me.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, John, for your call. Dwayne in Hayward is next. Hi, Dwayne.
Yeah, my condolences are taking care of your mother. I also take care of a 98-year-old mother and know all about the things one goes through every day.
Mm-hmm.
God bless you.
Yeah. It's a trial, but we do what we have to do.
That's right.
There's so many good things to talk about. I'm going to bring it back to guns. Everybody talks about common sense gun control. Why do we have background checks for people that already own guns? They already have guns. They already have access to guns. There's no need to have background checks on people who already own guns. It'd be simple. Background checks, if you don't own a gun, if you walk into a gun store and already have a possession of a gun, no need for a background check.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a very good point here. And again, you get right down to this issue of the Second Amendment. There are people who feel very, very passionately about it, that the Second Amendment is quite uncomplicated and quite specific, and that you have a right to own a gun. And it doesn't say anything about background checks or any of these other things that we're talking about. So you touch a nerve here, and I would just say, as an extension of this, I think the whole issue of the Constitution itself has come back into the fore here lately, with people more concerned now than they might have been, whether it amounts to guns or immigration or Social Security or any of these things, how these things relate to the functioning of the Constitution and that sort of thing. But I think the background check issue, however you do it, is going to be extremely controversial. There's just no question about it.
Thanks, Dwayne, for the call. Gordon in Milwaukee, hello.
Yeah, my question is, why do we keep opening dialogues with North Korea? And do you believe that it has a lot to do with our cuts to defense? And I'll take my question off the air, my answer off the air.
Well, I certainly do believe that this is one of the problems when we sort of tilt to cutting defense. I mean, not that there isn't waste in the Pentagon, but when you give the impression to any potential or would-be enemy or aggressor that you are not going to respond or that you are, quote-unquote, in some fashion soft, this has nothing to do per se. I mean, it's an issue with President Obama, but it's an issue with every president, frankly. And there's a lot of argument mentioning Adolf Hitler that this was, of course, the problem, that if Adolf Hitler had been dealt with effectively in the 1930s, World War II would never have occurred. So it is an issue here to some degree. But again, we have no idea what the North Koreans think on all of this, other than the fact that they hate the United States. If they had that capability, and nobody is really sure that they do, or don't, if they had the capability to strike the United States or to strike Hawaii or, you know, the west coast of the United States, would they do it? Can they do it? We simply don't know. And talks may help, but you have to be pretty Iron Lady-like to think about Margaret Thatcher again in these kind of talks. Otherwise, I think you're inviting a real problem.
Thanks, Gordon. Michael in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning. Oh, just on a quick side note, I just got done watching the original Jackie Robinson movie, which was made in 1950, which is on Hulu now. And the part is actually played by Jackie Robinson.
I thought that.
So
yeah.
That's out there. But the reason I really called is on this voter ID thing. You know, I keep hearing that off and on. I, like a lot of other people, don't believe that voter ID is a voter fraud is a problem. It's been proven in the past that it's not really an issue. I'm a firm believer that if there is any, and actually is, there is a voter fraud being perpetrated, but that's being perpetrated by the spending of huge sums of money to air misleading, lying, false, cheating commercials and advertisements, which sway the population and sway the vote, and steal elections. I mean, that's where the voter fraud is being perpetrated, by all this big money spending. And people that justify this voter ID bill all the time, and one of the things they always use and cite as an example is the requirement of the use of ID to negotiate our lives every day in society, and being the requirement by private businesses to show ID, whether it's an airplane. But I'll tell you what, my mother is 92 years old. When she goes to the store to buy a bottle of wine, they will not sell her that bottle of wine unless she produces an ID to prove that she's over 21 years old. And we certainly don't want to go into that direction with our voting booths. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Jeffrey.
Well, I just, you know, I have to say, I do think this exists. As a matter of fact, not long ago, I recall seeing on television, they found there was a woman in Ohio, who, and I believe she was on their local elections board. She voted herself. She voted for other members of her family. She was on camera saying, "Oh yeah, I voted six different times in the same election for other people," and she didn't see anything wrong with it. You know, well, they needed to vote and they couldn't, so I voted for them. And again, I know I have seen the photographs. I've written about this back in 2008. I've seen the photographs of places in Philadelphia that simply don't exist, and yet there were voters registered to that address who showed up and voted. So I can only tell you it is a problem here. I mean, that's certainly my belief, and I think there's plenty of evidence of it, and I don't think you have to look far for it.
And yet in the state of Wisconsin, there have been charges that it's been all over the place, too, and there have been like a handful of prosecutions, four or five, or I don't know the exact number, but it's fewer than 10, I think.
I myself think that one of the problems we have, and I would apply this to guns as well, is that we don't enforce a lot of the laws that we have. We have thousands of laws on the book about just about everything, and I'm not all that sure that a lot of them are enforced. I don't know how much is done to enforce voter, you know, the sanctity of voting rights, et cetera. I'm not at all sure how much is done to enforce existing gun control measures that are already on the books. I think that that is a real problem here.
Jeffrey, thanks. We're out of time.
Sure.
Thank you,
okay.
Sir.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Yep.
We'll talk again. Jeffrey Lord, contributing editor of the American Spectator, former Ronald Reagan White House political director and former aide to Jack Kemp. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have another hour to go. Please stay with us.